Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us wherever you are in Southern California or listening around the world to kpecc.org or the KPECC app. Coming up later this hour, our daily update, the latest on COVID-19. We'll be talking with UC Irvine School of Medicine professor and epidemiological expert Dr. Shruti Gohil. She'll be with us coming up later this hour. Next hour on Air Talk, we look at the demographic shift in Greater Los Angeles over the past three decades and what that means for specific communities. We'll hear from listeners who've been longtime residents to talk about the changes that they've seen and how that factors into political power in our region and what sorts of changes are coming in the future as a result of demographics. Also, yesterday, the California State Assembly passed a constitutional amendment proposal which would repeal Proposition 209 should voters approve that. It goes to the state Senate. Prop 209 banned any racial or ethnic preferences in state hiring or in college admissions among public colleges in California. But we begin today with the Justice in Policing Act. That's the name of the reform measure that House Democrats introduced formally yesterday, with multiple people testifying for and against the measure. It's expected to pass the House and to go to the Senate, where Republicans are in the majority. Republicans have not yet put forward their police reform measure, though it's expected there will be some. Also, President Trump, his advisors have said that they're hopeful they'll come up with a reform measure as well. But we're going to talk about what's specifically in the new bill that's introduced in the House and expected to pass there. Joining us is the president and CEO of the National Coalition on Black Civic Participation, the NCBCP, a civil rights and social justice organization. It's one of the major civil rights organization supporting the Justice in Policing Act, Melanie L. Campbell. Ms. Campbell, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you, Matt. And wish I was in California.
Thanks. It's Larry. That's all right. Matt's the producer you spoke with, but that's okay. Let's start right out with what this means for the legal determination about criminal conduct by an officer. This would make it easier for prosecutors to be able to charge and potentially convict officers. Can you explain a bit how this works?
First of all, let me say this. Thank you again for the invitation. I'm going to say on the front, and I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to get real lawyerly.
That's fine.
I'm an activist and an organizer, right, and a civil rights advocate. But the bottom line is really about accountability, being able to hold police officers accountable, who are the bad actors. And we know not all police are bad actors. It addresses ending racial profiling, right, really addressing that, and eliminates qualified immunity for law enforcement. It addresses something that predates you and me and everybody on this phone and even listeners, the systemic racism that it focuses on that and how that plays out in law enforcement and not just in law enforcement, but it is definitely there as we've all been living through these last few weeks based on what happened with George Floyd. And deals with accountability, but also it deals with community policing. In one of my other lives, I worked for the late Maynard Holbrook Jackson during when the Rodney King incident took place, and where you had more community policing, where there was relationships built. So it also addresses being able to deal with that side of the what we would call the front end. The back end is when something bad has happened, and we're dealing with accountability. But then also the front end of building more transparency and rebuilding relationships between the African American community and law enforcement, so that there's not just accountability, but building trust. That is also a way of dealing with public safety and making our communities safer.
Some advocates have said this bill doesn't go far enough. They want to see much more sweeping changes. Some have called for defunding the police, where you would take the majority of police funding up to 90% and redirect that money to social social services, housing, mental health, and community-based services. Do you think ideally that there should be something that goes further than this, or do you think that this adequately addresses the problems?
I think it's, first of all, knowing that most funding, as I mentioned, I work for in city government, and most funding that deals with policing and law enforcement is local, right? But the funding that comes from federal government, the idea of just being able to have some better accountability to address this, I think that's where folks are coming. The folks who are on defunding the police, I think depending on who you're talking to, people have a different idea of what that means. What you just mentioned, redirecting funds, that things that law enforcement doesn't want to do in the first place, social services types of things that get put into that could be redirected. So I'm not on the bandwagon of saying dismantle police departments, but I do say that we need to reimagine what law enforcement looks like so that I, as a black woman in this country, feel that law enforcement is there for me as to be a protector, protect and serve, and not have that idea of when I see my nephew walking out the house, worried about whether or not he's going to come home if he runs into a law enforcement officer. So that's where I stand on it. So I'm not a don't fund the police department, but I am of redirecting funds where it's feasible, but also understanding that this bill is not going to go but so far in that, because most funding doesn't come from the federal government. So it comes from getting right down into your local community and talking to the mayor and looking at and talking to your city council members and talking to your police departments and sheriff's departments and being able to figure out how we do this differently. And that's really where the real reform will take place.
We're talking with Melanie Campbell. She's president CEO of the NCBCP, the National Coalition on Black Civic Participation. They're one of the major civil rights organizations supporting the Justice in Policing Act, which was introduced yesterday by House Democrats and is expected to pass the House. Its future in the Senate is uncertain. Let me just share specifically what the bill would do, and our guests can also go deeper into this. But one of the principal aspects of this is that it would no longer require prosecutors charging officers with meeting the bar that the officer's actions were willful. That is a higher burden of proof. The law would allow an officer to be charged with acting with reckless disregard for someone's life, causing that person's death. So under the current law, it's a federal crime to willfully deprive someone of their civil rights under the color of authority. But the officer, it has to be shown that the officer must have known that what he or she was doing was wrong and against the law and still decided to do it. So for a prosecutor under the current federal law, the prosecutor has to convince a jury force used was more than what would be reasonably necessary to arrest or subdue a suspect. So convincing jurors in the midst of the arrest, the officer made a clear, willful decision to cause someone's harm, to cause their death. Also joining us in conversation is John Jay College of Criminal Justice, professor of law and political science, and former NYPD officer and former prosecutor Eugene O'Donnell. Professor, welcome back. We appreciate your being with us. Share with us your thoughts about the different aspects of this policing bill.
Well, policing needed a very serious conversation over the past 6 years. I predicted policing in the country would collapse. It has essentially collapsed at this point. We need to save some time on some of this conversation. The hard truth is that nobody wants to put on a police uniform in urban America. That has not been addressed for the last 6 years to this moment. No one is answering who will do the work. The work was already radioactive, and now will be totally unworkable and undoable. And when people talk about police abolition, we have to remember in city after city in the country, we do have police abolition. We have it in Detroit, you have it in Baltimore, you have it in Milwaukee. The police are not reliable partners there in terms of responding to emergency calls. We got high levels of violence. The definition of this conversation now is that conflict is abused by the police, coercion is abused by the police, and now you have the entire conversation revolving around the video. So in that sense, you've turned policing of the country into the CNN you know, overnight producer. One video can stop the entire city in its tracks. That's not a formulation that can work. So if anybody thinks you're not going to have videos of officers in doing things that are viscerally upsetting, that's an impossible standard. And something like police officers being in the work they do, pledging that they will never come in contact with somebody's neck, that's an impossible standard. So most people are very reasonable. The community is very reasonable. However, the most extreme, what, 3% of this conversation hijacked, not surprisingly. The on the other side, the right side of this conversation has nothing to say. They don't do cities. So we needed to have a very, very long, complicated conversation. But we should save our time. Policing is in its twilight era in the big cities. It has been. The number of interactions they've had has collapsed. But even others, even small departments, most departments have not been directly impacted by this out of 18,000. But every chief in the country now has to reckon with the fact that all the good the agency does in 3, 4, 5 years can be immediately eviscerated if the entire thing is going to be devolved to one event. And, of course, we really need to talk about the extraordinarily irresponsible way mayors have conducted themselves and have made their cities, in a time, by the way, where cities are going to be forlorn places now. Cities are going to shrink. There's not going to be a lot of reasons to come into cities. We had riots in which the police stood by, sometimes ordered, sometimes not, because they simply can't even protect themselves now because of this conversation. So this is a very deep, very important conversation. But the practical thing that stares us right in the face that I've been warning about for 6 years, the Obama administration did that commission that they didn't even address this. Where are the young people, any young people, anybody ambulatory? Forget about high standards. Somebody can just stand up. How many people are we going to get to want to be in urban policing? And this is, again, but one of the issues in places like Minneapolis is they have walked themselves into a situation where they've essentially abolished the police anyway, so they may as well do it because nobody would want to have the job.
Okay.
Policing.
Let's talk about some of the specifics. And you're mentioning that you can have one disturbing videotape, and then that launches the whole conversation and takes it over. But the what the concern is, of course, is that that's not an aberration. That there are multiple instances of police using excessive force or even acting with malice against individuals, and that it reveals an ongoing practice of discriminatory behavior by police that needs to be dealt with. We even hear from law enforcement officers themselves on this program are highly critical of their departments and talk about a culture within the department, a mentality that can run roughshod over communities. So do you not think that that's an important conversation to have and that it goes beyond the one disturbing video?
Well, I can speak about New York, where the facts and the data are absolutely clear, laid out on the table, irrefutable, that that's one of the most restrained police departments in the country, probably in the world, in the work they do. And you can prove it in every metric. And by the way, in New York, I can speak specifically about New York, where video has been going for 24/7 for the last 5 or 6 years, with some notable exceptions. Okay. Almost every police interaction in that city, 5 million calls a year, 25 million calls in 5 years. Almost every interaction is being recorded. Where are the abusive videos in New York City? There really aren't many videos. The sum total of all of the complaints of the Civilian Complaint Review Board in New York City, and forget about even the founded ones, even the extravagantly untrue ones, is a couple of thousand. And I've been saying this, CCRB, open up your files and show us all these bad things. The truth of the matter is, that the police not responding, the police not taking care of problems, the police not being reliable in communities where they're most needed, that is an epidemic issue. And a few die when the police do their job. Thousands of people have died and will continue to die when the police don't do their job.
We're talking with Eugene O'Donnell, John Jay College of Criminal Justice, professor of law and police science, former NYPD officer. Let me go back to Melanie Campbell of the National Coalition on Black Civic Participation. Professor O'Donnell was saying that in cities like Detroit and Baltimore, essentially, the police are taking a hands-off position because of how they've been cast. Your response to that?
Well, I work a lot with, I mentioned that I worked on a local level, and I would disagree on some level of that. I work with NOBLE, National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives, who's a member of our organization and sits on my board, so I work very closely with at least African-American law enforcement officers and chiefs of police and all of that, to make sure that the work that we do, which is on the civil rights side, is a balanced approach to that. What I do remember, and when I worked in city government, and I worked a lot with law enforcement to deal with things like how do we de-escalate and work to deal with issues around gun violence or working with gangs in the community, and that the relationships that need to be built, the idea of doing more, having more support around community policing does matter. Things like having police officers who live in community wherever that's feasible, and there are relationships. I do believe that the glass half full is still possible. I'm not disputing someone who's worked in law enforcement. I myself have never worked in law enforcement, but I have worked with law enforcement for 30 years in working around issues of building trust and relationships in community. So I do believe that there is the opportunity through this Justice and Policing Act, because there is areas in here that is not only about the punitive side, but the community side of building relationships and being able to provide those things, so that law enforcement officers don't have to carry the burden of being in social services. Those kinds of things I think are possible if we can just find ways that we can find what can work. How can we do this better? How can we, because the community needs it. Our young people are demanding it. You know, most of these young people who are on the streets, they want to see a better future for, and so for those of us who've been around, I want to try to help that. And that's one of the reasons our organization is even involved in this. This is not what I do every day, but it's related to the work of working on a democracy that's going to thrive, how that impacts law enforcement. There is a relationship.
I appreciate it very much. I know you have to go, but thank you for being with us. President, CEO of the National Coalition on Black Civic Participation, Melanie L. Campbell, her organization, one of the major civil rights organizations supporting the Justice in Policing Act, introduced this week in the House of Representatives. We're going to continue our conversation of what's in the bill. We'll hear from supporters and critics. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us. Later this hour, we'll talk with Dr. Shruti Gohill of UC Irvine School of Medicine. She's an infectious disease and epidemiological expert. We'll talk with her about the latest on COVID-19. Right now, we're talking about the bill that was introduced this week in the House of Representatives. It's called the Justice in Policing Act. It does a number of things, including creating a national database of excessive force uses by law enforcement. It bans certain types of police holds and also calls for, under federal legal standards, a lower burden of proof required to convict officers of abuse of force leading to the death of someone in custody. Let's introduce the conversation now. Retired chief of police in California with 30 years experience in law enforcement. He's also a consultant who works with different organizations. Tommy Tucson. Thank you very much, Dr. Tucson, for joining us on Air Talk. What do you see as the aspects of this Justice in Policing that you think are positive?
There's so much to go over, Larry, and I'll try to be brief. Law enforcement is not at a paradigm destruction. It is at a paradigm shift. Having been in policing since the 70s and 80s, I knew that this day would come upon us. And so rather than talk about doom and gloom, I'm going to talk about, from being a policeman, from working the streets in California, which is kind of a large area, I want to talk about restructuring. Part of the Criminal Justice Act talks about restructuring. Absolutely, we need to restructure. In the restructuring, we need to look at hiring. This issue did not just happen now. I remember getting out of the police academy in 1980, going out in my police car and hearing the N-word different times as I was working patrol. And it didn't come from citizens. It came from fellow officers. So I knew I was in for it. So what we need to do is I'm also a member of Noble. And this is my fourth social unrest in my life.
Now, Noble is a National Association of Black Law Enforcement.
Black Law Enforcement Executives. Right, Noble. National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives. And most of the members are chiefs or lieutenants and above. So Cedric Alexander was the president when I was a member. I'm still a member of Noble. And we have talked about this issue for a long time. Now, the training, the restructuring, the hiring is going to be looked at in a lot deeper, as it should have been. We have all been saying for years in Noble, we need to change what we're doing. A lot of the issues in that Criminal Justice Reform Act deal with authority and who is in charge. Is it the police unions or the police chief? As a chief, I can tell you, many times I wanted to discipline officers, remove officers, suspend or fire officers, could not do so because of the due process provisions and police union contracts. That's what you're seeing manifest itself across the country. Look who speaks out against police misconduct and tries to defend it. It's not the chiefs of police. We've all said what was done to the tragic loss of life of George Floyd was unconscionable, and we can't believe it. So looking at, and then the hands-off comment that was made earlier, it's called the Ferguson effect. After what happened in Ferguson, Missouri with Michael Brown, police officers did not want to get involved because their first thought is, am I going to be sued if I take action? So looking at the act, it gets into some very testy waters, and I think it should be not jumped into. I think you should take a lot longer approach to quickly analyze what it is you're looking for.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask you, because you were talking about significant changes in recruitment and in training of officers. But the point Professor Eugene O'Donnell was making is that already it's very difficult to hire police officers, certainly the case in Los Angeles, where they have many unfilled positions. And part of it's you're getting people who even can be vetted and go through the process. But do you think it is possible to staff police departments if the standards become even more selective, particularly with the kinds of public criticism of law enforcement officers?
Absolutely. I have taught in colleges in California and been a policeman in California for many, many years, several decades. I will tell you right now, I know 200 kids that want to be police officers at one college that I'm at. I know another college where there's probably about 300 that want to be. So, no, they still want to be it. They still want to do it. But, you know, we have a duty to society to make sure we hire the right people. The psychological exam, for instance, is the MMPI. We've been doing that since the 1970s. And you can see the results over the last four decades. We need to change how officers are screened. And we have personnel history reports that are done and everybody hired. I don't believe that they're given the full force and effect to reject and disqualify people, and they're getting hired. Minnesota officer is a perfect example. We have internal affairs investigations, but they're done by officers within the agency, so there's not a real balance and control, and I think that needs to take place. But we need to look at the hiring practices. Training, I'm not sure what they do in New York, but in California, our police academies are probably the most anywhere in the country with over 900 hours of training. That's more than most states put together in training individually. And that training, what we have missed through this whole conversation, how are we talking to officers about handling communities of color? How are they talking to people of color? Do they understand the frustration, the animosity, the distrust that is in communities of color when they're in the academy? Well, we train in academies for 80 to 200 hours in crime scene investigation, traffic investigations, etc. The time we spent training on diversity, cultural mores and differences is generally less than 15 hours out of a 900-hour academy. And this is probably the norm nationwide. That has to change. Education and training has to be the new direction for law enforcement and community members collectively.
All right. We're talking with retired police chief in California, Dr. Tommy Tunson. He's with us along with Eugene O'Donnell, John Jay College of Criminal Justice professor. I'm particularly interested in hearing from those of you who've been in law enforcement. We've heard from those who've been in law enforcement who have critical things to say, what sorts of reforms they think need to be done, others who feel that it's unfair that terrible incidents are being used to define policing generally. We welcome your calls at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Let me go back to Professor Eugene O'Donnell. Your response to what we've heard from Dr. Tucson, that he thinks there are plenty of people going to law enforcement with even more rigorous standards.
Well, it's just provably not true. The evidence is everywhere that policing is in collapse, and the Police Executive Research Foundation has documented and recruitment pools collapsed prior to these events by 90%. And this was a poisonous, hateful campaign against the police, not from the community, by the way, not from the community. Community has not, the police and the community, frontline cops and the community are silenced in all of this. While an extreme fringe, many people have no connection to a community. Many people who themselves want their own safety protected are totally disregarding of the community's safety. But if anybody thinks the poisonous, vitriolic hate campaign that ran against the police online and on the streets, where people went into the streets to fight with the police, provoke the police, direct hate speech at the police, target African-American cops in uniform, that's going to help recruiting generally, or if African-Americans are going to want to be in this job. The objective evidence now is, in a gig economy, by the way, this is an economy where there's a police jobs pay well, there's pensions, there's benefits, and those jobs are literally going begging all over the place. And you're at a point now where the people who would want to be in policing, you would have to think long and hard about whether you would put them into the jobs.
What about the relationship between communities of color and law enforcement? And we've had in Los Angeles some success with particular targeted groups that go into communities, really spend time there, interact and build relationships. But, you know, that's not universal. And that's something that civil rights activists in Los Angeles have argued needs to be significantly expanded. What do you think would improve police relationships between, you know, themselves and communities of color?
Well, bluntly, you cannot have the conversation dominated with a hate campaign towards the police. The well is totally poisoned. So if anybody thinks the police are amenable now to a conversation about human rights generally, after they've been kicked up and down the street and vilified, and thousands of people, I haven't seen anybody say anything terrible about Mr. Floyd, thank heavens, but I've seen tens of thousands of the most horrific, vile, hateful posts that have been made against the police. So you're policing a city where the people that run the city have avowedly said they hate you. I don't think that's true on the ground. I don't think it's true, not measurably true. The police continue to be popular, even in places where they do the conflictive work. But the mayor of the city in these cities, the mayor is making the most irresponsible, unhinged comments and agreeing to the most absurd demands, and it has been political gold dust.
We're talking with Eugene O'Donnell, John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Here in Los Angeles, polling done by the Center for the Study of L.A. at Loyola Marymount University, by our guest Fernando Guerra, who's going to be joining us next hour, by the way, showed that there's a significant difference in how African-American Angelenos view law enforcement than other sectors of the city of Los Angeles. Relations considerably better between Latino and Anglo and Asian American Angelenos than among African Americans, even though there's still, even among African Americans in that poll, a significant degree of support. But let me go back to Tommy Tucson to respond to that. What we hear from Professor O'Donnell is the well is poisoned by the rhetoric, and we can't get anywhere reform-wise with that kind of a tone.
It's going to be a hard battle. What he says is true as far as the flavor and the feeling, but out in California, I'm a little bit more optimistic. We hear the rhetoric, we hear the discontent, But I will tell you, the focus that I'm kind of looking at is trying to recruit more African Americans. PERF that he talked about is an excellent, excellent source of information, but I deal more with NOBLE, which is a national organization of black law enforcement executives, and there's a different view on how we do this. And I don't give up. He's right. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be hard. But I know a lot of young people out in California want to get in. It is hard to think that, wow, they hate me just because I'm a cop. Well, no. One of the programs that I've initiated in California that I'll soon be bringing to the East Coast, particularly New Jersey, is what I call Transformational Policing Model, TPM. TPM is a 50-50 training tool where I've used it at Sacramento Police Department, and you know they had their issues. And what I do in TPM is in the classroom, I have 50% of police officers and 50% of community members. And like the professor said at John Jay, there is a lot of animosity in the room. Officers feel like they're not trusted, they're not valued, so they don't want to do their job. But you'll find that when you put them both together in the same room, and I keep the crowd, the classrooms down to 50, 25, 25, and Sacramento Police Department should be commended because from the chief on down, he has directed over the two-year period that I've been doing this, all of his department go through the training. You will find in the training that first hour or two, and I'm the moderator, is very caustic and very difficult. Community expresses their distrust and dishate of the police. Police talk about being the target of animosity, anger, and hatred. By the afternoon of the first day, I hear police officers coming to me on the side because being a chief puts me in a whole different category than being an officer because I understand from the executive management level all the way through because I came up as a line level officer. But the officers are saying, wow, they still feel that way about me even though I've done nothing to them. Community members say, wow, they really care about us and they want to make a difference. Community-oriented policing, my TPM, is an elevated and amplified version of that. And you will find that after you do this type of training, the only training for law enforcement that's going to be effective is joint 50-50 training, where you collaborate with the community and the police officers in the same room. There are some tough comments that come from both sides during this training, but I have found that it really helps to break down the barrier and restore trust.
I want to thank you for being with us, retired police chief in California, 30 years law enforcement experience, Tommy Tucson, also from John Jay College of Criminal Justice, professor of law and political science, Eugene O'Donnell, former NYPD officer and former prosecutor as well. Justice Now tweets at AirTalk, gays were bashed by cops in West Hollywood after gay cops were hired. Abuse in the gay community declined. Cops should live in the zip code they patrol. Cops will care about the area they live and where their kids go to school. The community hired each cop to 1-year contract with a job review. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page. Anita in Mid-City LA says, I think there needs to be a larger reform for protection of African Americans by law enforcement. She says, I'm an African American who's had police called on me because of a false claim, and the police immediately took the accuser's side. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, the KPCC app, and kpcc.org. Coming up, our daily update on COVID-19 in 90 seconds.